Wish you knew more about the medical device industry and how you can do your job more effectively and put your career on the fast track? Then stay tuned while industry veteran Pat Cothey shares strategies and tips from customers and company insiders who help drive the industry. Now let's join Pat as he explores how you can master medical device.
Welcome. I'm fascinated with how leaders learn and develop, and in the paths they've taken to get where they are today. In medical device, it's common to see people taking on new challenges and moving up within their own company. It's also common for people to move to new opportunities and join teams and companies of the same or different size. Some skill sets transfer. However, some do not. What can you do to assure you're preparing for the broadest set of opportunities? Well, we're going to explore that in today's conversation. Our guest today is Raleigh Carlson, CEO of Immune Express, a company that's pioneering technology that can rapidly detect sepsis. Raleigh contributed to the success of Abbott Laboratories for 20 years, starting off in R&D, then transitioning to leadership positions in global businesses and startups within Abbott. His attraction to startups led him to become CEO of Asuragen and then Wafergen Biosystems. In this episode, we discuss how he prepared for new opportunities, the benefits of extreme ownership, balancing company vision and mission, alignment of everyone inside a company, why sepsis is such a big problem, and what Immune Express is doing to help clinicians better manage sepsis patients. Here's our conversation. Raleigh, the first 20 years of your career was spent at Abbott, large company, large resources, and then you transitioned out of there into startup world. So tell me a little bit about why you did that and what drew you to startups.
I went into Abbott actually on the R&D side. I was a marine biologist by training, PhD, and Abbott was interested in looking for natural products from the sea for their pharmaceutical programs. And what Abbott was able to do is provide resources much broader than what we have right now, and to be able to fund basic R&D, but at the end of the day, it was really get a product out. And during the course of my career in R&D, Abbott was a great learning venue for me in the fact that the practicality of developing a product was something, and using the product by the customer and fulfilling a customer need was really ingrained in the culture there. What Abbott really represented was a diverse healthcare company, and then for me, it was one where I could transition from leading R&D programs into actually leading business units there. And I really loved doing that. I raised my hand for a lot of opportunities, took advantage of the diversity where I had both pharmaceutical businesses and diagnostic businesses. And the last business opportunity I had at Abbott, the president, Rick Gonzalez, who's now CEO of AbbVie at this point, we acquired a small company called Visus in the Chicago area. And Visus was a molecular diagnostic company, fast growing, and had a very strong brand, and really focused on oncology and genetic disease testing. And Rick asked if I'd be interested in joining that company, running it as president, as an affiliate of Abbott, but unlike what we would normally do, which would be to assimilate and indoctrinate business into the Abbott culture, it was to be run separately. And so that was a great opportunity. We had myself, one finance person, one R&D person sort of parachute into a company of 100 people that were quite entrepreneur, very passionate about what they were doing, and they were on a growth trajectory. And it's how could I be able to help resource that, and how could I be able to take advantage of the infrastructure of Abbott and to be able to grow that. And it was really rewarding. And we ran the company separately. We did take advantage of internationally and other opportunities that Abbott resources that we had, but grew the company at a growth rate of well over 60% per year, and developed and got FDA clearances for some key products, one for breast cancer diagnostics, path vision, and probably one of the most successful molecular diagnostic products called Eurovision. We grew to the point where we had to be assimilated by Abbott into Abbott Molecular. And I was being offered some great other additional opportunities in Abbott, but they were to be leading a large organization, $500 million plus. You were responsible for that business, but as I learned, if you wanted to move in a direction and steer the ship to 60 degrees or something like that, it might take 6 to 9 months to be able to do that. And the culture that I found at Bicis was that you could take action, be quick on your feet, and be able to change direction if necessary, and which is very important in biotechnology because the best laid plans aren't necessarily the way it turns out, and you need to be able to adapt to the marketplace. So I actually looked at my career and I said I could be very successful at Abbott and continue. It's a great company, still is. However, for myself and fulfillment for myself, I go, I'd like to be on the other side and be able to grow something and be part of the beginning of a technology group and see what I can contribute.
The way companies are managed and who's managing them is, it's always interested me and where they're coming from. There's a lot of finance people who run companies. People come up on the marketing side. It's my impression that not as many R&D folks come up and become the CEO of the company. Is that your impression too?
I would agree. As far as small companies, startups, many times it'll be a technology founder in that regard. But really, when you're moving into the operating side, and company I'm with right now is an example of that. You know, the founders did a great job as far as developing early stage, you know, technology, but it's really implementing that as far as being successful and having adoption in the medical community. And generally, R&D people don't have that experience, you know, when they are going and developing their careers. Fortunately, at Abbott, which are going back to, you know, with Abbott, is my first product that I developed, they said, well, congratulations, here it is, you guys go launch it. And it was management philosophy was, au contraire, you're staying with this product and you're going to be out there for 2 to 3 years, you know, helping to support that product and find out what's working and what's not. And it was really useful because it really made you think much deeper when you're developing the next product as far as what sort of product need, market inputs that you need to have to develop that and made you better and stronger from an R&D perspective. But the fact that I had the opportunity to work for 2 to 3 years on the front line with sales, with marketing, and certainly at Abbott, which was very fiscally conservative and measurement oriented, put it that way, you really had to have results. And so as a consequence of that, all those other inputs and necessary, you know, abilities, you know, if one could be able to develop that, are the ingredients, I think, for being a successful CEO.
Do you remember back when they said, go ahead and take the commercial side of it? What were you thinking at that point? Was it exciting, scary? What was it like?
It was exciting and scary at the same time. I mean, I actually, it was a circumstance where our commercial leadership had moved on and there was a void there. Our product was really taking off and I was really, you know, supporting that. And I raised my hand. I said, you know, I can do this. And quite frankly, I was, you know, rolled out of the office a couple times by the president of the division. But I think that after some unsuccessful candidates came in, then they were willing to take a shot and let me have that opportunity. And so it was one where I think that really working in conjunction with marketing, you know, there's certainly sales is important, but having a plan and being able to arm the salespeople with the right tools, which in biotechnology, it's going to be technical, but it's going to have to be something that's going to be simple enough, you know, that the medical community sees what the value is and you can adopt it in the whatever that medical paradigm that you're trying to improve.
So this was back in the 90s?
Yes, that's right.
So back in the 90s, marketing and R&D had a handshake, but they weren't tied in general. They weren't tied in together as tightly as they are today. So at least that's my experience. When you were transitioning over to this, is this something that you saw that you needed to do from a career development standpoint? or was it just an opportunistic thing? I mean, were you actively managing your career and wanted to get that downstream experience, or was it just this opportunity was there and said, hey, I can do this?
Well, it was both. I think the motivation was I wanted this. I had put a lot of time and effort in my R&D program to develop a product, and I didn't see that it was being positioned, you know, correctly. And I thought that, and I wanted it to be successful. From my perspective, from somewhat selfish standpoint, I go, this is a great product. I know it can be successful, but it's just not being stewarded the right way, you know, from that standpoint.
I trust me. I don't trust you.
Exactly. And so what happened was, is my transition was, okay, you can lead the marketing group and the sales group will be, you know, independent of that. And to your point where the R&D and marketing weren't in sync necessarily with one another, that was my job. I knew I had to be successful to do that. And we're very successful in that regard. And then that evolved to where I was able to take and run the whole business unit.
So for someone who's in their career right now, and they could be in the marketing track, they could be in the R&D track, could be in the quality track, what do you think about cross-training, or what's your opinion on cross-training and getting experiences outside of your chosen track?
Oh, I'm a huge advocate of that, and in almost all my organizations, you talk about getting out of your comfort zone, and typically, you know, as one, I'm a marketer, I'm a quality regulatory person, or something like that. You know, people just don't really think about that. If you can have diverse, experiences and be able to integrate, you know, not only what your foundational expertise is, but then be able to expand that into other domains, it's very useful. It's very useful from an individual's career perspective because it becomes more versatile, you know, overall. And I think from a business standpoint, it helps the business because then you're not only looking at it from the lens or silo of your domain, you know, you're looking at it from a more comprehensive, you know, business perspective. And it gets, it gets more alignment within the organization because we're here to have goals to be able to accomplish something, and we're all sort of in the same boat rowing together.
It really is walk a mile in my shoes. Yeah. So
that's right.
You don't understand my problems. You don't understand my limitations. You don't understand my passions. Now getting in there and understanding it from somebody else's viewpoint, it will help you as you start to manage things going farther
Absolutely.
Along.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you identified that this is a passion of yours. You don't want to, you want to make sure that you have immediate impact, and decisions are not the 6 to 9 month decisions. You can have immediate impact and be nimble, and the startup side kind of worked for you. When you moved into startup land, it's a big difference. Abbott's got all of those dollars behind you. You just go shake the money tree and stuff falls off. Not quite the same in startup land and resources as well. What was that like when you moved into the startup world?
Well, fortunately, I did have that Vices experience. So I really was, that was a very good sort of transition experience for me overall. I went to a company called Asurgen, which was just starting up. It was a spin out of a company called Ambion that had been purchased by Applied Biosystems. And the founder really had core technology that was very exciting, microRNAs for both therapeutic and diagnostic purposes, and wanted to have somebody who was experienced in both pharmaceuticals and diagnostics, which is me. And when I interviewed for that that job, I was in Austin, Texas, and it was interesting. The founder said, well, here's our business plan. Read this tonight, and then let's talk about it tomorrow. And the let's talk about it tomorrow was a group of 10 people who had developed this business plan around the table and asked me, what did you think about it? And at first I said, and what I have found, which is really the core attribute, I think, of a small company, is highly aspirational and very much looking for shooting for the stars. But I asked them, I said, I think it's great aspiration, but I think you guys are smoking something from a business perspective, because, you know, We're not going to be $10 million in 2 years based upon a new technology that nobody's ever seen before and never been clinically validated. And that was not the answer that they wanted to hear. There was no question about it. You know, there are, you know, what are markets that you want to be in? Are there bridge technologies we can do? If this is a foundational core technology, we're going to need to be able to develop it. It can do a number of things, but we have to get to know as far as all the opportunities for that and really focus in that regard. And I came back in Chicago and I told my wife, well, that's a job I won't be getting. I got a phone call and I moved to Austin, Texas and joined the company.
Let's talk a little bit about vision and mission, because in the startups, when you put that vision statement down, and it is aspirational, it's who you want to be when you grow up, but you never get there unless you can dial in on the mission statement very tightly. So when you're in that type of position as the leader of the company, you want to have that vision. How do you dig down and how do you determine what that mission is?
Well, I think the mission, you have to keep the, frankly, the end customer and market in mind. And then how are you going to be able to access? I mean, if we had a vision of being, you know, the microRNA company, you know, and for medical solutions, and then it's like, okay, what are we going to, how and what are we going to fulfill in that regard? And the how and why is what you have to build on. At Abbott, when I was a scientist there, basically I was advised, you know, innovation is very important, but you need to be an Edisonian type of scientist. And I, well, what does that mean? Well, it's 10% is the innovation and 90% is the perspiration of being able to make that happen and make that reality. And so you have to be able to build the scaffolding and the house by which everybody's going to be working under to be successful. And I think the mission is everybody needs to understand and believe in it, you know, because if they don't, if they're here, and that's a difference. I mean, Abbott, there's no question the intent of the whole organization was to provide, you know, newer innovations and products to help healthcare, you know, on a broader basis. But owning it, you know, perhaps not everybody owned it, you know, and in a smaller company, everybody needs to own it, or they may not be in the right place.
I think a lot of us, too, as leaders within companies, you get tired of saying the same thing. But unless you say the same thing, it doesn't get lived. And a mission statement is one of those things where, you know, annually you look at your vision statement, look at your vision, your mission statement, and say, okay, these are what we want to be, and you put that back. But everyone wasn't in that room developing that vision and mission statement, and everyone doesn't hear that routinely. And if you don't hear something routinely, it doesn't become ingrained. So it really has to be strongly and repetitively put out there in order to filter it and make sure that it gets across to everybody in the organization.
As you get products into the marketplace, and Asuragen was one that had multiple products, but as they were in the market and making a difference, we had employee meetings, and then we would actually have customers come in and tell us what the value of the technology and products that we had brought to their a solution for their healthcare situation, and in some cases patients, you know, that were positively impacted. So that's where you want the organization. Actually, yes, leadership has to be able to repeat that, but hopefully you want the organization, adopting it and promoting it themselves. And different ways that you can be able to have that occur, I think, is really important. And even if you don't have a product on market, about, you know, somebody coming in and understanding, here's our medical need, this is what we need, if we could have this, we could have that. You know, the marketing people who are looking at product market fit, certainly they're doing that type of research. But for the organization to understand that, I think that helps. And of course, the smaller the organization, the easier it is to do that. There's no question.
Absolutely. So we've talked a little bit about newer technologies and value creation based on new things. And as an R&D person, I'm assuming that's one of the things that's at your core.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, the intersection of novel technologies that could potentially be a new solution for a classic unmet medical need, that's really the jazz. And it's also the challenge, you know, because particularly if you're bringing a technology that's going to change medical practice, that's not easy to do, you know, because medical practice is pretty ingrained and many times generational overall. The opportunity is there for a new technology, but the challenge is how are you going to be able to make that successful?
Ideas come from a lot of different places. It could come from a technology that's been developed in another field that can be applied to yours. It can come directly from the customer, can come from ideas that people inside a company have. What do you think about capturing these ideas? What's the best methodology that you've seen to capture different ideas to get to that intersection?
Well, capturing, I do want to say first is that many times what is thought to be a good idea may not be right for that time. And sometimes actually what are thought to be two bad ideas can come together and be a wonderful idea in that regard.
And yeah, that's like the Post-it notes from 3M. It was a poor adhesive that caused that to happen.
Exactly. And so it may not be right for the time, might be later, per later. You know, or there's a necessary element of this that has to happen for this idea to be able to be potentially viable in that regard. And I think that, yeah, for capturing that, certainly you want to be able to set aside for brainstorming, you know, in that regard. But when you're in product development, then you're in a situation where you really need to be really structuring all of that to get to answers, yes, no answers. And no could be just as good as yes, because you could spend a lot of time, a lot of money in trying to overcome something where, you know, perhaps, you know, you can't do it. Or maybe the best thing to do is pick up the phone and try to partner with somebody that might have the capability of that particular element to do that. And that's a challenge for not only large, but particularly small organizations, because, you know, there's a strong sort of not invented here type of attitude here, NIH factor, I would say. And you can't afford that. You can't afford that in a small company when your resources are limited. And you're also under a time crunch. I mean, you need to get something, you know, that's going to be a quality product out in as short amount of time as possible. But the worst thing you can do is be able to come up with something that doesn't fulfill a market need. You spend all that time, all that money, and then you're struggling to keep the company going.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about research and development. Two different words, research and development, and how R&D is different in a large company versus a small company, a startup company. Is it different, and how is it different?
Well, it is, and it depends upon the company, though. From a company perspective, R&D should be little r and big D, from my perspective. And you look at, obviously, your budgets and what sort of proportion. You know, in larger companies, there's a tolerance to be able to have of your R&D budget, so to speak, have about 20% of that be in the R world, and then the rest was associated with development. So in smaller companies, hopefully the initial R has been done, you know, and so you've got the essence of what that is. And the challenge is to get out of that R mode and into development. And do you have the right people to do that? And in many cases, smaller companies don't. Then you're really getting into the factor where, and this is a founder syndrome, you know, quite I see many, many, many times where this is great technology, it'll sell itself, and you look at all the things that need to happen in between and in the true development side of things that have to happen. Development is going to consume most of your budget. You have to make sure that you're on the right track to have something successful. From my standpoint, you know, the moving from R to D is you have to get across what I call a feasibility threshold. And feasibility is really a proof of concept, because if you can't do that at that early stage, you're not going to be on the right track from a development standpoint. And if you can't do proof of concept, you know what, that idea, that concept, you need to kill it or change it or do something, you know, take that other idea and merge it with it and make it better.
I've always found the R&D name to be a little bit off, because a lot of the research that we're doing is not research into how to manufacture something or the properties of a material or anything like that, but it's research that's done into the application of the product. It's research that's done into what the physicians want, how the workflow works. It's those types of customer discovery things, which often don't reside within the R&D department. They may reside in the marketing department. So you're doing research, but it's not the traditional R&D department's responsibility only. I mean, they have that responsibility too, but other people are doing that research side as well.
Yeah, and clinical research too, medical clinical as well. The vast majority of technologies that, for example, Abbott, which became AbbVie. I was on the acquisition team at Abbott when we were looking at buying BASF specifically for Humira, which was not cleared. We had an R&D team that was looking at autoimmune diseases, really knew that anti-alpha TNF factors were something that were in the future. Did we discover any of that? No, we just we knew the science and we knew, we were looking at what's the best one that's out there. And you look at the first, fully humanized antibody that was out there, in Humira, that was the catalyst for us converging, which was, one, do the deal, and the other is put that into your clinical development program. And then what else would complement that from the next, what would a drug candidate, for example, and you build a franchise in that regard.
So we spend a lot of time in the R&D side. That's your heritage. That's your background. But you're CEO. You've been CEO of a company, president, CEO for a long time. Let's talk a little bit about being a CEO of a company, because you've had the opportunity to be a CEO of a private company as well as public companies. Tell me a little bit about that and how it's different, how you do your job differently as a publicly traded CEO versus private.
Well, of course, responsibility of a CEO, whether it's private or public, is making sure you have adequate funding and raising money, in that regard. And when you're private, you're generally in the venture and private equity world. And you have, hopefully and generally, your investors are understand what you're doing and know what the milestones that might be associated with that. When you're publicly at a NASDAQ company, which Wavergen Biosystems in the Bay Area, which had great technology, in fact, probably the most sophisticated technology that I've been around and had to manage, a single cell analysis, being able to do a whole genome from a single cell. But my investors didn't understand, what we were doing. And I had to spend more time, the reporting responsibilities, all of what's necessary to stay, on being a listed company on a quarterly basis was time consuming. And you had to spend a lot of time with your investors. On the one hand, if you needed to raise additional money, you can do, shelf registrations. There's a completely different process that you do. And you can get access to resources and if you're publicly listed, as long as you're performing, I'd say easier than a private company, and particularly at this time in this day and age here, when really investments in private companies are very challenging.
One of the other challenges that we all have, whether in large companies, small companies, is building the team, managing the team. How's it different in an Abbott, when you're hired a lot of people and you've got a lot of resources to do it, and it's a certain type of person that likes to work for the big company, and then there's the startup. How is team building different in the big company versus the small company?
We talked about vision and mission, and I think it's harder to do that in a larger company and try to get everybody to be motivated the same way, you know. There's also sort of job security factor, particularly in the past, it was viewed as larger companies, there was more job security, so therefore they were employees would be insulated. At Abbott, we were very much, we always went through what we called every year an organizational inventory, OI review. And during that, we would look at what, you know, you classify your organization and you try to find out who's your top 10% or performers, you know, and the top 25 and what they're contributing, et cetera, along those lines. And we were actually challenged that in our top 10%ers, that you wanted to give them other opportunities, and many times that's outside of your own business, which was, you know, incongruent with you as a business manager saying, I need that person to be successful in that regard. You know, you want to have top performers in whatever organization you have. But I think that when you get to smaller organizations, you have to wear so many more hats than you do in a larger company. You know, we talked about being siloed before. You can't, I mean, I'm wearing more hats now than I think I've had in many, many years, you know, in that regard, because, you know, in certain functions, you may not have the representation that you are used to having or experience, put it that way. You know, you look for people in your organization, in a larger company, you're really looking for them to fulfill that position and that domain expertise. Whereas, you know, in a smaller company, it's a, okay, they have to have obviously some domain expertise, but what else can they contribute to? My current company, for example, it was really a discovery and development, biomarker discovery and development company. But now we developed the product. It's in the commercialization stage. Many of the individuals have never gone through sort of that transition from development to being commercial. One has to be able to, one, are you willing to embrace taking on other responsibilities and sort of this is not in my domain? In smaller companies, there's certainly a willingness for that. And that goes back to sort of the passion, the mission, everybody on board. You know, I'm pleased to see people are doing things that they haven't never done before, you know, and they're starting to excel at that. And the company's expecting, you know, an employee to be able to contribute. We might give them, you know, options or equity and things along those lines. But it's really important for each employee and individual to build their own equity. And by, I think the way they build their own equity is to have more of that diverse sort of experience and under their belt that they have capabilities in a number of different domains. That will help them not only in their current job, but when they're looking at the next opportunity. And, you know, nowadays, that job security, whether it's a large or small company, is no longer really the, you know, an assumption anymore that way.
When you were describing early on in your career, you had that extreme ownership and you wanted to make sure your product was done right. So you stepped out and you benefited by that. And then as your company grows, your job as a CEO is to fire yourself from other jobs. Okay. I'm growing. So now I can bring somebody in to run the marketing organization, sales organization, enablement, all of these different things. You're doing it. But the bargain that you made with the company is you have made it successful and you have built not only the company, but you built things into yourself that allow you to take that out into other areas, and you're more valuable to other companies by having that breadth of experience.
Yeah, that's a good summary. Very good.
So let's talk about your current company, Immune Express. Very interesting space that you guys are playing in. So tell me a little bit about the company and the problem that you're solving.
Well, Immune Express, based here in Seattle, we're a private company and we're a small company, and we've been working in the gene discovery world for a number of years, and a lot of that technology was founded in Australia, and we're looking at actually human host response to infectious disease, and we have discovered novel genes that are associated and expressed, either overexpressed or underexpressed, due to a pathogen or infection, but not just a pathogen infection that leads to sepsis. And sepsis is what our focus is. And we are looking at trying to work on technologies and develop products that can detect sepsis early, because sepsis is a dysfunctional host response to inflammation that results in organ dysfunction and failure and death. And many times what looks like you can detect sepsis in the late stages, certainly, but you can't be able to intervene at that point. Or the mortality rate is very high, or morbidity rate is very high. And we all know examples, I think, of that. It can lead to severe amputeeism if somebody survives. It's a worldwide problem. In the U.S., it's the number one cause of death in the hospital. It's also the single greatest expense category, even though it only represents about 5 to 6% of cases in the hospital. And as each hour goes by and one does have sepsis, the probability of mortality goes up by 8% per hour. So it's very important to be able to catch it and catch it early. Quite frankly, there aren't technologies that are out there. What we have developed is, and what we found was that if a human has an infection that's leading to sepsis, there's certain genes that are overexpressed on white blood cells. But early stages of sepsis looks like what is called systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS, which looks like sepsis with a pathogen, but does not lead to that. It's an ephemeral inflammatory response. So with sepsis, what is essentially happening is your immune system is overstimulated. You start going down the cytokine cascade, and that results. So we found that if a human has SIRS, systemic inflammatory response syndrome, without an infection, that there's certain genes that are downregulated. So as a consequence, what we did was we actually went through hundreds of genes and narrowed it down to a 2 to 4 marker system that if a patient is infected and it's leading to sepsis, that a gene is overexpressed and the other genes don't move at all. And if indeed they're having a systemic inflammatory response, then that gene does not move at all, and the other ones actually are down regulated. So we're, as a consequence of that, the difference between if those genes expression, we can come up with a prediction of likelihood of sepsis. And, that's what we developed. That's what we got FDA cleared in the end of 2021, and we're in the midst of commercializing.
Let's go back for a second and talk about current technology and how things are done. So somebody comes into the hospital and they've got an infection and tests are run. So at what point are they saying this person is septic or not septic? What's the current testing methodology? What's the current diagnosis of sepsis like?
It's a challenge. And so if a physician right now has to be able to look at multiple inputs to make a determination as do they think that this is probably sepsis. They'll look at white blood cell count, they'll look at fever, tachycardia, lactate levels, perfusion. But there's no gold standard. And so they're looking at about 10 or 12 inputs and trying to make that sort of determination. If there is a gold standard, it's blood culture. And so if I suspect that this patient is becoming septic, I'll take a blood draw and be able to culture that up. And I won't get a result for maybe 18 to 24 to 48 hours, if at all. In fact, in research shows and in our own clinical studies, that even when somebody is septic with a bacterial infection, you only get a positive blood culture back about 15% of the time. So in the meantime, physician basically, when in doubt, I'm going to treat as sepsis. And certainly if there is sepsis occurring and it's due to a bacteria, administration of antibiotics is very important to get on and be able to have broad spectrum antibiotics immediately. But large epidemiological studies have shown that 43% of the time when a physician has admitted a patient to the ICU and said, this patient is septic. 43% of the time, they did not have it. So therefore, you've got other etiologies. That patient is sick, but they're being treated for sepsis. And so one, you're ignoring what else is going on. It could be cardiovascular. It could be, you know, a brain bleed, something else in that regard that needs to get treated and treated a different way. So it's very important to be able to rule in sepsis. And at that point in time, then yes, indeed, you do start your broad antibiotics. And at that point in time, you're being able to comply with what CMS says is that between 1 and 3 hours, you need to be able to, if somebody is septic, you need to be able to be administering treatment. In the case of patients that have kidney disease, for example, broad spectrum antibiotic could actually lead to mortality in and of itself. So it's very important to be able to, at that early stage, when doctors are really essentially, it's a flip of the coin, to be able to rule in or rule out sepsis.
I spent some time in the concussion marketplace, and concussions are a constellation of symptoms is basically what it is. And it's similar here. Sepsis is a constellation of other things that people say, well, it's probably sepsis, but we won't know until 18 hours, 24 hours till we get it back. So we're gonna make a choice to start you on antibiotics or not start you on antibiotics. And what you talked about with, if someone is undiagnosed, they have sepsis, but it's undiagnosed, every hour that goes by that you're not treating it, it increases the death rate by 8%. That's if we're looking at it from the sepsis viewpoint. If you're looking at it from cardiothoracic or cardiac disease standpoint or cardiac event standpoint, and they don't diagnose the cardiac event because they think it's sepsis, well, now you start looking at what the risk is for somebody that was not diagnosed for that. So the key here is we're talking about how do you get a valid diagnosis as soon as possible so you can hit the disease or hit the injury with the appropriate treatment immediately so that you have better outcomes. So it's all about the diagnosis.
Absolutely. You know, there's roughly 5,000 hospitals in the U.S. And they're within probably about 450, you know, hospital systems. And they all go about sort of their early diagnosis of sepsis differently. Systems typically have what they call a sepsis bundle, that if we suspect sepsis, we will do this, you know, in that regard. And there's versions of that, which many of that is driven by EMR systems that have early warning sepsis programs. There are algorithms from Epic and Cerner, for example, that say they take those factors, come up with an algorithm, and they'll predict sepsis. But what's going on now is that they'll call it, you know, alarm fatigue. I mean, the EMR is calling it sepsis. The sepsis team will be going there to look at patient, and indeed they do not have them. So basically, those systems are being turned off. But CMS is measuring every 6 months hospitals' compliance with what they call the sepsis bundle. Are you administering and testing to make sure that you're in compliance with triaging that sepsis patient? And when they met the overall nationwide score is about 60% compliance with that. And the range is between 20 and 80%, even in the same hospital system. So what one really needs to have is in their sepsis bundle, a way to be able to early on be able to tell whether or not, you know, predict that sepsis or not, and then you could be able to get that patient on the appropriate bundle or look for those other etiologies. And that's exactly how we're positioning, you know, our test, Septicite Rapid, in the hospital to be able to help improve really compliance to your sepsis bundle and CMS 1 to 3 hour resuscitation bundle.
So what is Septicite Rapid? Tell me a little bit about the machine, the technology, what you're testing.
Sure. So what we're testing is actually the gene expression off of white blood cells. We're measuring messenger mRNA by a highly sensitive PCR test. When I first got into molecular diagnostics, if one was to do a gene test, basically you had to have three rooms with about five different pieces of equipment, one for isolation, one for purification, one for amplification, and you had to make sure that there was no contamination at all. So our test we've developed is actually in this cartridge in my hand, and this is essentially that whole molecular three lab system in the palm of my hand.
And then for those that are listening, it's roughly the size of two decks of cards. Put two decks of cards on top of each other. That's about how big it is.
That's right. Absolutely. And this contains all the reagents that are necessary to be able to do the extraction, purification, isolation, et cetera, like that. And what we do is we take actually about 1 mL of whole blood, and I'm opening up what is a port on the top of the cartridge here that you would inject 1 mL of blood in. You close the cartridge up, then you actually put this cartridge in what looks like a DVD instrument, a tray, press the button, it goes in. That actually does the amplification and the PCR reading in and of itself. And then within about 1 hour, you have a result. So you think about the current gold standard, takes 18 to 24 to 48 hours. We can come and say, this patient has a high probability of sepsis, so therefore, rule in, get on this patient, from a septic standpoint, or low probability of sepsis, which means you should be looking at for other etiologies.
So, Raleigh, that cartridge is specific to sepsis. Is my assumption that you'll have other cartridges for other types of diseases?
Yes, I mean we're staying within our sepsis focus at this point in time. But the follow-on test that we have is the next question is, okay, is it sepsis? And if indeed it is, what's causing that? And I think that everybody knows now that after the pandemic that COVID is something that we've all experienced, but about 30% of deaths associated with COVID were due to COVID sepsis. And viral sepsis was not on the radar, quite frankly, as much as bacterial. And sepsis can be done, maybe due to both bacterial, viral, and fungal infections. But the next question from a treatment standpoint is, okay, if sepsis, is it bacterial or is it viral? Because you're going to do very different types of treatments, modalities for that. And certainly if it's viral sepsis, it's a waste of time putting, antibiotics, administered to that patient. So we have, and we're developing that in the same cartridge. If sepsis, then is it bacterial or is it viral? And that's what's in our pipeline right now. And then finally, we are able to determine if it's bacterial, is it gram positive or gram negative, because then you would administer different specific antibiotics instead of broad spectrum ones.
So you received your regulatory clearance in the U.S., Europe as well?
Yes. Yeah, we have CE mark.
And this occurred in the middle of COVID?
Yes, that was a challenge. We were doing our clinical, our final clinical trials when COVID hit. And that obviously slowed things down because hospitals were being overwhelmed with accrual of the number of patients that we needed. But on the other hand, it gave us the opportunity where we had never, the test was developed when there was no COVID. And then all of a sudden, COVID is now is a reality, and we know it's going to be a reality for some time. So how well does the test work with COVID patients? So we conducted additional trials with COVID patients in both in Europe and the U.S., and one determined that highly accurate for determining COVID sepsis as well. And that was part of the submission. And then the other was actually, with COVID patients show up at the hospital COVID positive, one didn't know whether or not they'd progress to severe COVID cases or not. It was very difficult to do that. And the test did a very good job of being able to predict who would end up in an ICU 2 or 3 days later in that regard. we finally finished our clinical trial, and then the FDA was only giving clearances to COVID tests, you know, at that point in time. So we had an extended review under that case. But we were fortunate we were one of the first tests that were non-COVID that were cleared by the FDA. And that was really at the very end of 2021.
These are not point-of-care testing machines. They're in the lab. Is that correct?
That's correct. So they're not CLIA waived. We say near to patient because it's very simple. You know, one to administer, one only has to be able to know how to pipe that blood in that regard.
So does a nurse draw the blood and then just send that vial down to the lab, or do they put it into the cartridge and send the cartridge down?
Well, that's a great question. In the U.S., many hospitals have what they call a stat lab, which sits between the ER and the ICU. So that's a very quick exchange. You know, we found that in our work, we get a result back to the physician in about an hour and 40 minutes. However, in Europe, they are using it. They're actually putting the instrument, you know, right in the ICU or the ED, and you actually have both nurses and doctors that are actually doing the test itself directly themselves. That is very useful for them for fast turnaround, but for us, as far as training and everything along those lines, we have to train a lot more people to be able to administer that versus a med tech.
Yeah, the other thing I was wondering about is it's in the machine for an hour?
That's correct.
So you may need multiple machines if you're in an ED that has multiple patients in there too.
The instrument itself has a footprint a little bit larger than a PC, a standard PC. And there's a console that goes with it that can drive eight instruments at one time. We think, you know, typically a customer and customers that we have two to three instruments. And so those are random access at that point in time. One is running, another sample can come in, you can load that up and get that going as well.
So Raleigh, rolling out a diagnostic like this has got a couple of challenges with it. You have to educate the people that are in the lab. They're making the decision. They're the decision makers for it. But then training people to order that or to understand that test is available is another part of the sale as well. So what kind of challenges have you seen in rolling this product out?
Well, first challenge was that we launched, the pandemic was still ongoing, you know, and so in obviously 2022, getting access to the hospital was very difficult. I mean, you could not get face-to-face with people as we typically would try to do. And the issue is that in sepsis is really sort of a, as you say, it's a constellation of symptoms, but it's also a team sport as far as you have both either a critical care doctor or an emergency department doctor, infectious disease, critical care nurse, and then you have the laboratory. So it's really important to be able to have education for all of those different disciplines. We have CME courses that we had for critical care nurses for describing sepsis and sepsis management, and then how our tests could be administered. Society for Critical Care Medicine is one where we have collaborators that are that have won our clinical trial sites, but then also now are adopting as customers, provide webinars and seminars in that regard. And just recently, the CDC has come out with sepsis guidelines, and one of their findings is that there's no single sort of owner of sepsis. Some hospitals have a sepsis coordinator, many do not. And it's really important to have somebody that has ownership. For us, if there is a sepsis committee, then that's who we want to get in front of, you know, because that brings all of those different disciplines together, because they're the ones who put together what their sepsis bundle is and what they're going to apply that for.
I was recently in the hospital with a friend of mine who had sepsis, and for those of us in the business, we forget about what it's like to be a patient and what the patient's questions really are and who's managing that patient. Going to the ED, have a preliminary diagnosis, same exact thing as we talked about. Think it's probably sepsis, don't know, won't know for 24 hours. But just the amount of physicians and PAs that are coming in, there's not one person, there's a group that manages you. So you're trying to figure out which person you're going to see. That person is now off for the next 2 days. Now you got a new person from that group coming in. Who's in charge of the PT? Who's in charge of the medical care? From a patient standpoint, it's really difficult to do that. But also, it's who's driving the boat here? Who's in charge of this? Because you get different people in charge of different things. That ownership of whatever disease it is just so important. And it's also important that the patient knows what it is. That's the practical side of it. The medical side is, you know, is kind of what we always focus on, but the practical side is as well. So having that one owner as, who did you say, CDC is
really pushing
putting
that
as an issue. Yeah. Having that one owner is really important.
Well, it's a real challenge for, you know, hospital, you know, clinicians, you know, just in general, you know, with the pandemic, I mean, there's been a lot of attrition as well. And many EDs and ICUs are actually short-staffed as a consequence of that. Introducing something new, whether it's our product or any other new product into that backdrop is a challenge. And so it has to be a meaningful product for them to be able to adopt. You know, one thing you can have like these sepsis owners and the sepsis committee and the larger systems have that. But when you think about the 100-bed hospital that is out there where they don't have that infrastructure at all, and we're seeing there's a lot of interest in our tests and saying, look, we don't have all this resident expertise. You know, we need they're very focused on the patient, you know, and making that determination. You know, for us to make the call on sepsis is difficult for us to do. So a test like ours could be quite beneficial, you know, for their management.
What has the response been?
As you look at for customers for Innovative Medical, there's always going to be the ones who are more entrepreneur and are interested in new technologies and evaluations of that. For us, we have customers in the U.S. and in Europe. Many of them, even though it's FDA cleared, you have clinical trials, want to be able to see how the tests works in their system. So we've got a number of the processes, evaluations, you know, and because this is in a CLIA lab, they have to meet their CLIA standards. And I think that it's, you know, the diversity of hospitals, but also there's the diversity of needs. Like, and you need to be very sensitive to, you know, what is your sepsis problem? Do you have a sepsis problem? And certain institutions say it's our inpatient. You know, so these are actually patients that are already in post-surgery, things along those lines, where we have a lot of difficulty. So therefore, what sort of studies do you have in that regard, which we published on? Others are about screening. This is not a screening test. I mean, they're ill. I mean, there's something going on there. So it's not like screen everybody who comes into the ED. And for us, it's really, if you're thinking of doing a blood draw for that patient, that's when you really need to be looking at this test. But use cases are very important. And so and different institutions have different needs.
The benefits of a technology like this are so great. And you think about the decrease of mortality alone there, but then you've got length of stay, you've got antibiotic usage, you've got antibiotic resistance. You got a whole host of different benefits that kind of come in here. Who is the main decision maker when it comes to this? Is it the CEO or the C-level people who are looking at the cost side of it? Is it the medical management people? Where's the greatest benefit?
Well, I mean, there's clearly a cost benefit for reducing length of stay, as to your point. the critical care physician and critical care nurses, I think, are central to this. They need the tools, and they know they have to have that. From a finance standpoint, I mean, we have a unique ICD-10 code specific for the test. And, you know, if you look at the single largest clawback from Medicare and insurers for reimbursement are related to the sepsis DRG codes, of which there's about 20 of them. And just back in before the pandemic, there was an audit of three states, and the clawback was in the order of $280 million, and that's out of pocket. The other is, if you look at sepsis as the leading cause of readmission of a patient to a hospital within 30 days. And if that happens, then it's the hospital eats the cost of care of that patient. CMS or insurers will not do that. So making sure that a patient may not still have residual sort of sepsis, so to speak, at discharge is very, very important in that regard. So as we talk to C-suite, CFOs really zero in on that, so do CEOs in that regard. And CMOs is very much about, you know, improving quality of care.
Business model, let's just quickly do that. So we've got a couple of machines are going to go into the lab, and then you've got cartridges that, you know, I'm assuming you're charging per cartridge for this. Scope me, about how much are we talking about for these pieces of equipment?
Well, the instruments are roughly about $50,000 each, and the cartridge price range between $175 and $225. And I'd say that, you know, it's usually an early adoption. There's many, many cases where there's going to be a lease or rent of the instrument, and then that would be done at an upcharge for the cartridge. And then as you get more adoption, then that, from my experience, you see a transition to where you get more direct capital purchase. From a capital purchase standpoint, that, you know, that is something that doesn't necessarily fly under the radar, but doesn't really hit the capital review board, so to speak. So you're not in that sort of annual cycle, so to speak.
Is the is that business model common within the diagnostic space, to have a cartridge, to have capital equipment?
Yes. Yeah. Very much so.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for sharing this information. Just a fascinating area, and an area where diagnosis can make a huge difference in patient outcomes, as well as correct use of medical care. To kind of wrap things up, I want to ask you a little bit about your experience within our space. You've got some miles behind you, as do I, and seen a lot of changes, not only within how care is delivered and how medicine is practiced, but also how companies have functioned and how we're all different than we were years ago. So if you're going to pick out a couple of things in your experience that have really been extremely positive changes to either medicine, how medicine is practiced, or how us as companies serve the medical community, What would be a couple of those things?
Personalized medicine is becoming more of a reality. And I think that's something that was an aspiration, I think, when I was early in my career overall, but really not practiced as much. And I do think that if you see some of the breakthrough drugs, particularly like in cancer, for example, if you look at, CML management for leukemia, how now, I mean, basically, in the beginning of my career, you had a situation where if you had that diagnosis, the likelihood of mortality within 3 years was extremely high. Now, because of one, good diagnostics, understanding the genetic technologies, and one reason I enjoy molecular diagnostics and targeted molecular therapies are the fact that you understand the mechanism. You can be able to try to, one, diagnose, in this case, that was BCR-ABL fusion gene that actually had a damaging protein as a consequence. And then Novartis was able to target that specifically with a drug, Gleevec, and that just changed that just changed things around. The dilemma of value that diagnostics brings and the cost of diagnostics relative to interventions and therapy hasn't changed. And quite frankly, is if you look at it where, the costs of diagnostics are 10% or less of total healthcare costs, but they drive about 90-95% of what is the downstream decision makes and intervention, there's a disparity there. And so what has not improved is reimbursement, quite frankly, for the value of what diagnostics have brought to the table. And I had one example, though, when I was at Visus, and I was mentioning PathVysion and Eurovysion. At the same time, we were trying to get improved reimbursement through CMS for this technology that we had. And we were quite successful in doing that. And in doing that, that really would help really drive adoption of those products, and which were phenomenal growth, in that regard. That's not the case on a broader basis. We talked about this from a company standpoint, the view that large companies were safer, so to speak, to be able to, and you can have a whole career there. I think that as evidence over the past 2 years, and even before that, that's not the case, whether it's large or small companies. So I do think when you see, you do see a lot of employee migration, as a consequence, not only of a reduction in force, but the fact of the matter is a quote unquote loyalty to a company is one where I believe that you really have to have an employee believing in the purpose of what they're doing. And that's much more important now that it's meaningful that what you're doing is making a difference and they feel that they're making a difference as well. And I think that's a positive, quite frankly. That's really useful. And then if they're building the skill sets, as we talked about earlier, and in the broadcast, I think that, if they develop their own equity, that's going to benefit not only their careers, but I think the benefit healthcare overall, because you have better products and better management.
Leaders can come from any discipline within a company. I was really glad Raleigh shared his journey, because there's a lot that can be taken from it and can be applied to our journeys as well. A few of my takeaways. First, cross-training. You benefit, you learn. You learn a lot about yourself and other parts of the company and how to make things successful with it within a company. You also make yourself more valuable to the company. And the other thing it does, it helps to break down or prevents the formation of silos within a company. So cross-training can be a really valuable thing for both you and the company. Second, the R&D function. And we spent a lot of time talking about different topics within R&D. Raleigh talked about the percent of R versus D. Big companies, 20% R, 80% D, but much smaller with smaller companies when you have a mission to do and not a lot of cash to do it in. So that 20-80 doesn't really apply when you start dealing with startups. And he discussed the feasibility threshold. You need to make sure that your product idea is feasible to do, so proof of concept. And he said if you can't get there, you need to kill it, change it, or merge it with another idea. The other thing he discussed in this R&D function is incorporating people outside of R&D into research. Traditional R&D actually extends out beyond the people in the R&D department. The final thing was diagnostic devices. So many of us are in therapeutic devices, but the diagnostic market is so important. The impact on patient outcomes and overall costs is greatly influenced by the ability to quickly and accurately diagnose the situation. Yet, as Raleigh said, reimbursement in this area has been lacking. Well, it's really time to give this issue some emphasis. Thank you for listening. Make sure you get episodes downloaded to your device automatically by liking or subscribing to the Mastering Medical Device Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Also, please spread the word and tell a friend or two to listen to the Mastering Medical Device Podcast, as interviews like today's can help you become a more effective medical device leader. Work hard. Be kind.